So time now for another Creatrium podcast, and once again I'm joined by one of my erstwhile colleagues. This time it's Alan Thomas, Lord of the Axe and course leader for popular and commercial music, who's joined us with his replete with a guitar,
which you grabbed
on the way in, which is
permission.
I think they know it's gone, but there we are. Yeah. So Al, thanks very much for coming in. I don't know whether you've ever heard Creatrium. I guess you never have.
No, I haven't.
Which is the correct answer, which is fine, which is normal.
Yeah.
So Creatrium, the idea of Creatrium is it's a portmanteau of creativity in the atrium, and the idea is, because it's a faculty of creative industries, it's suggested, isn't it, that therefore people within that faculty will have a creative approach to life. So I just ask people about what they're about, how creativity impacts on what they do, that works within the kind of day-to-day routines within the university. Because, I mean, you're a musician, but you've been here for a long time. You're known as an ace guitarist. You've repaired a couple of mine over the years. Another look at them. But the guitar playing and music and everything to do with that is kind of what you do.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your role these days and a little bit about your history at the university.
Okay, well, I started off as a guitar teacher. I was called back in 2004 or 5 or something like that, where we were based up in Treforest. And the course back then was ran by Paul Carr, Professor Paul Carr, and... they were looking for a guitar teacher. So I went up and had to chat with them and got grilled a bit, and sort of informal interview. And that's how I started, really, teaching bass and guitar to first and second year students. And from there, I picked up a few more hours. I've always been interested and quite obsessive about music theory. I'm quite geeky in those terms. So I started teaching theory classes. And then an opportunity came about 2008, I think, to develop like the Welsh language stream.
Yes.
On the course.
Yes.
So I was awarded a teaching fellowship. So that was my inroads then into a full-time position here. Oh. So I did that for 3 years, developing sort of Welsh provision within the music department at large. Really.
So the Welsh language, obviously, very dear to your heart.
Yes.
And I've heard you before now with being the man with the stick at the graduation ceremony.
Of course,
which you did very
that.
Well, you know.
I enjoy that. I enjoy banging a stick on the
floor. On the stage and everything, and then giving it all in Welsh. But how important is the Welsh language to you? I think you're quite passionate about kind of making it work, and I suppose in your case, particularly in the realm of music.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's of ultimate importance, really. I don't even think about it. It's my first language. I remember a time when I didn't understand English, you know. My older brother was 2 years ahead of me. I remember him and his mates coming around when I was about, I don't know, 4 or 5, and they were talking English at me, and I couldn't understand. It was gibberish. So it's the most natural thing in the world for me to be Welsh, you know. I've always noticed that I speak Welsh to animals and babies, so it's my default, I guess. But I think in terms of the culture, obviously music, poetry, the arts at large, the arts in general is a big part of Welsh language culture. So that's one of the things I'm really grateful for, is that singing, dancing, playing instruments, performing on stage was completely naturalised for me from a very young age.
Where did you grow up?
I moved around a lot. My dad worked for the civil service, so I grew up in... I was born in the Heath in Cardiff, went to Mellyn Griffith Welsh Language School. Then I spent around close to 10 years, I think, in Bangor.
Right.
And went to a school Trevan, another Welsh language school. And in the interim, before then, I had a stint in Aberystwyth as well.
So yeah. How long were you in Aberystwyth for then?
About one school term. We couldn't find a house.
I was trying to kind of place your accent, because for me it sounds quite just to the north of West Wales kind of thing.
Okay. You
know, somewhere between those two sort of things. Not full-on North Walian accent.
No, I've lived in north, south, mid, and my folks are from West Wales.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It was a very short stint in Aberystwyth because the family couldn't find a home. We were living in a caravan in Borth, I think. Eventually, because it was so cold, like we all got ill, and my dad said, we've had enough. We're moving back to Bangor, and he got a bedsit for a few years.
Do you find that I'm asking you kind of a question I kind of know, really, but just for the people who don't speak Welsh and know about Wales very much, tell us a little bit about the kind of cultural geography of Welsh within Wales, there's kind of hot spots and there's different kinds of Welsh and colloquialisms and all kinds of stuff, isn't there?
Yeah, there are sort of like areas which are like when I was up in North Wales, like especially if you're in places like Carnarvon or Bangor, or like in the villages surrounding, like Bethesda and Anglesey as well, Ynysmon, you know, if you were to enter a shop, you know, you would try Welsh first. You would speak Welsh first, and that would be the assumption that everyone would speak Welsh. And especially, it's the same on the Llyn Peninsula, often enough. Obviously, there are a lot of Welsh speakers in Cardiff, but
They're well hidden.
They're well hidden. We're not, you know, we look the same as non-Welsh speakers.
Yes, look normal.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think a lot of people think sometimes, oh, there's not a lot of Welsh speakers in Cardiff. And there are. You just can't spot them until you start talking to them, really. And
do you see yourself as a Cardiffian?
Because yeah.
That's where you were born, but you're a bit of a mongrel, I suppose.
A bit of a mongrel, yeah, I guess. Yeah, no, I've always considered myself a Cardiff boy, I think. I've got this, sorry to interrupt, I've got this thing, you know, what I'm kind of a bit of a pariah, is that the right word? Like, because when I was in North Wales, when I moved to North Wales, I was the Huntu. I was the lad from South Wales. And then when I moved back to Cardiff, people had forgotten that I originally came from here.
Yeah.
So I was the Gog then.
Yeah.
So yeah, wherever I am, I'm from somewhere else.
Yeah. Do you feel kind of saddened, I suppose, by the perception of Cardiff as being a bit of a kind of cosmopolitan kind of place, even though it's the capital city of Wales, where it's not recognised, apart from the rugby and whatever, it's not recognised as being the kind of bastion of Welsh language in Wales, is it?
Possibly, yeah. It's not something I've put a great deal of thought into, really. I don't think I feel saddened by that. I think it's good that it's a cosmopolitan city and yeah, and having, you know, beyond Welsh and English, that there are many languages spoken in the city as well, isn't there? So
I mean that North Wales, South Wales thing, no one talks Welsh down there.
I think that's a bit upsetting. Yeah, yeah. That needs some work. And you know, it's obviously like it's easy to get west to east and east to west. It's easy for us in the south to get to Bristol, and transport links up north would be a lot better getting to, you know, it's easier to get to Liverpool or London than it is to get to Cardiff from Bangor, for example, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it may be a geographical issue and a transport issue, maybe, really. But
what about music? And because I believe there's a guitar over there. It may even be something like a Fender or what is it?
I think it's a Yamaha acoustic. It's a Yamaha acoustic guitar.
Yamaha, yeah. So I mean, I rarely see you with that. I don't know, you can make a little noise, and I just approve. There's a guitar. I just make a little. I'll do. Yeah, that's it.
There you go.
So I rarely see you without a guitar in your hand or around you in the office. It kind of runs through your soul, really, doesn't it?
I'm quite obsessed with the instrument. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about your love of guitar playing and music and why it matters to you, and you know, how did you, you know, what's driven you on to be so obsessive about guitars?
Well, I think I've always played musical instruments. Obviously, again, going back to this like Welsh language culture thing, where it's second nature and it's more or less expected for students to engage and children to engage with these sort of things. It was my idea that I wanted to play guitar. So my mother encouraged me to do piano, which I enjoyed for a bit. Then I went on to brass, played cornet in a local brass band. But the guitar was my idea. I approached my parents and said, I want a guitar. So that was a big deal, I think.
Yeah.
Of the whole thing. And yeah, so I got my dad's friend lent me a guitar when I was, I don't know, 12, 13. Went from there. My brass tutor was also a guitar player, so he said to me, if I practice really hard on the brass, rather than give me an hour's cornet lesson, he would allocate the last 15 minutes to a guitar lesson. So I did that. And yeah, just really enjoyed playing. And I, again, like it was an opportunity for me to play more popular music and more sort of pop and rock, really.
Yeah.
And then I think when I was about 15, I heard a player called Steve I.
He's not bad.
He's all right. Yeah, I heard an album called Passion and Warfare, and it just blew me away. I'd never considered that a guitar could sound like that.
Yeah.
And all these sounds that he was doing and all these techniques that he was employing, it was a complete mystery to me. So I became obsessive, and obviously it was harder those days. I didn't have access to internet. I was reliant on sort of tablature books and books from music stores, and knowing a kid who's a bit older than you lived up to the street who knew one more chord than you, and hoping that he'd teach you that. Yeah. But yeah, I remember just waking up, getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning just to get an hour or two practicing before I had to go to school, and then rushing back and playing some more. And if I needed to go to the loo, I'd take the guitar with me to the loo. And yeah.
And you went through the bit where your fingertips get all sore and all the rest of it, and then they become hard.
And then they became like cat paws. Calloused.
You didn't have to use the old, what's it called, pickling vinegar and all that
stuff.
No, that was an old wives' tale.
Trick.
Yeah. But you can you remember? You've got a guitar there with you. I don't know whether you can remember. Can you remember kind of, or maybe I'll put it a different way. If there was a, if I was a brand new guitarist, is there a, what's the kind of first kind of thing you would show me or explain? Or is it like a is there any kind of tutorials or kind of techniques and repetitive things that you would sort of start off with?
Well, the first thing I learned, I think the first song, I remember learning the first song, which was Painted Black.
Oh, by, yeah, what a great Stones. Song to learn first.
Yeah, just the chords, just playing the chords. Yeah. I think it's, I don't know if it's the right key from the track, or just A minor and E, really. But I remember the first thing that really got me into the freedom of like pop and rock music was improvising.
Yeah.
And I've always, and I remember it was a lad called Simon Spott. That wasn't his real name, but he was called Simon, but I think...
Good name.
Yeah. The surname was a nickname.
Yeah.
And he showed me a pentatonic scale, a minor pentatonic scale. And he said, you can play any note of this scale on top
I'm
of
glad
anything.
You said this, because I've played for a long, long time.
Okay.
I've got like platonic and catatonic, about the only two scales I know. You know, I'm really,
right.
I struggle. Could you show me that?
So this is a... So that's A minor pentatonic scale. So it's a five-note scale.
Mm.
And it's very easy to deal with. And you can just play around with these notes and... It's very conducive for improvising, I suppose.
Sick.
And it's also very easy on the fingers. There's no stretching. There's only two notes per string. So it suits the ergonomics of a guitar. So I think, yeah, that's... Obviously, my improvising, I think all my solos at the start when I was 14 would have sounded like this, just going up and down the scale. Then I'd go up for a bit of variation. Yeah, that developed into sort of... Yeah, that definitely helped my love for improvisation and things
so
like that.
So can you explain to me, like, I've played in bands for years and whatever, and I'm more of a chord merchant than a singer and a songwriter, really, you know. But I know I just don't have the technical dexterity, I don't think, to ever be a lead guitarist. I feel like I could learn parts, I can play parts.
Yeah.
I'm not terrible, but it's just not what I do. So explain to me, how and why... Learning the scales is so useful and so important if you ever want a solo.
I think it's just developing that sort of muscle memory and that dexterity. And, you know, it doesn't have to be a scale. There can be patterns. I used to do, like, these exercises and just sit in, like, certain things you can do in front of the telly. Obviously, I was trying to, like, maximise my time on the guitar.
Do you know any of those? Could you show me one of those?
Yeah, just, like, little... Just using all the fingers. So you've got... you use four fingers, generally. Hendrix used to use his thumb a lot as well.
Oh, yeah.
But just little sort of chromatic things where I'm moving through all my fingers one at a time. And just developing these and then trying to think of permutations of that and variations. So you can do string skipping.
It sounds great straight away, doesn't it?
And then rather than going 1, 2, 3, 4, what about sort of varying that? So I'll try, in terms of fingering, 1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 3, 4, 1, 3, 4, 1, 2, 4, 1, 2, 3.
Wow, just sounds
again,
like jazz.
Yeah, it does. Instantly sounds like jazz. Yeah.
Wow. How long would it take you to, you know, I mean, I remember somebody else telling me about this, actually. I think what you said about muscle memory, maybe that resonated with me. Is the idea that the thing to do, and I don't really agree with this, is just to play these things really quite slowly.
Yeah.
At first, and quite slowly, and slowly and slowly, to build up that actual muscle memory there.
Yeah, I think, that's the thing. I think people try and get up to speed too quickly, if that makes sense. So I was speaking to a guy when I was out in Australia, and he was an ex-US military guy. I think he was in the Navy, or what do they call them over there, the Marines.
Mm.
He said that when they used to teach them to draw their guns, they'd do... teach them to do it slow, because and this is his words, not mine, slow is smooth and smooth is fast. So
right,
if you can learn to do smooth with minimal movement, that allows you then to translate that and speed that up. And slow is smooth and smooth is fast. That's always stuck with me.
You do the stuff which I'm, you know, impresses me. I'm in.
Yeah.
Now, certain things, like, for example, when you're playing there, I notice, you know, blimey, you know, I know you teach guitar and whatever. From some people, it's the kind of downstrokes, upstrokes thing when you're trying to pick that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And have a natural kind of, you know.
Yeah.
And that kind of ability to do that, even, you know.
Yeah.
Comfortably, just flit up and down. Yeah. I know we're on the radio here, but kind of, you know what I mean, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. Well, what would you like me to do in terms of that? Because it's just getting used to those movements. Obviously, these aren't movements that we do every day.
You do.
Yeah, but you have to get used to it. Obviously, like, well, this is the thing I used to tell my students, if, especially when they get het up with feeling a bit that they're not progressing very much. The first time you pick up the guitar, it's going to feel like an alien thing in terms of positioning and how you hold yourself and the ergonomics of the whole thing. To remind myself of what that felt like and how far you've come, I often flip the guitar over.
Oh, wow.
And try and play left-handed, and then all of a sudden you've got...
Blimey.
You can remember what it was like.
Can you play left-handed?
No. I can do it, but I'm trying to strum an E chord now. But this is what it would have felt like for me.
Yeah, yeah.
Back in the day, and when, you know, changing chords, and okay, oh my God, I'm going to try and do a...
Hendrix played upside down.
A now. Yeah. So, yeah, just to remind yourself, that's where you used to be at.
Yeah. Why did Hendrix do that then? Why did he flip a guitar around?
I think people... To be honest, I did the same. I started playing left-handed. So when my dad's friend brought his acoustic guitar on for me to borrow, I placed it on my lap the wrong way around. So I
because
naturally...
Because you were mirroring him?
Not really. No? That's just what felt right. Mm. And that's what would have felt right to Jimi Hendrix, I guess. And he would have stuck with that because no one would have told him any different. And it's fine. But my dad's friend told me, no, you're holding that the wrong way around.
Yeah.
So I just persevered with... the other way, doing it right-handed, I guess.
And the rest is history in your case, really. When did you, I don't know if you read this book, but a book by, he's not everyone's cup of tea by any means, but Jules Holland, and he wrote this book about his kind of career as a musician and whatever. I think it's called something Boast and Boogie Woogie, something or other.
Okay.
A really good book. But he talked about the fact when he was a young kid, probably 12, 13, you know, like yourself, or around about, maybe a bit younger.
Yeah.
And there was a piano in his uncle's house or something like this. And he started playing it, and it was, you know, he just sort of came naturally to him, and he sort of started playing his boogie woogie stuff quite quickly, and he could just kind of do it. You know, did you have that?
No,
you didn't. They didn't come to you the same way, like a rebel. I can actually do this.
No,
well, no.
It was the opposite. One of the impetuses for getting the guitar was me and the boys in school wanted to join a band, so three of us got guitars.
This is your first band?
Yeah.
Which was?
I think we were called Apollo B.
Okay.
Because Apollo was the god of music and we were...
Great.
Apollo B. Yeah, very arrogant of us.
Where was this?
This was up in Bangor as
okay.
well. Okay. Yeah. So I was all set to play bass. I wanted to play bass to start with. And I remember going into Picton Arcade again with my father. And the guy just questioned me. I don't know why, but he questioned me and said, why do you want a bass guitar? Do you play guitar? I said, no, I want to play bass. Why do you want to play bass? Oh, because me and the boys are putting a band together. Those two, the other two are going to get guitars and I'm going to get a bass. And the guy said to me, that's not how it works. He said, you all get guitars and after 6 months, whoever's the most rubbish guitar player, you stick him on bass.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's what happened. And so I got a guitar. It was a red Axis Stratocaster copy.
Wow.
And I wasn't a natural. My other two friends, they were the naturally gifted guitar players, really. And that annoyed me. And I was really competitive.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just worked harder and just, like I said, got up at 6 o'clock in the morning and getting 2 hours practicing before school.
I think that is, I mean, I'm reading some articles recently about guitar, which I'll maybe come on to in a bit, but one of the things about it is the competitive nature of guitar playing.
Yeah.
In particular with guitar, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, yeah. And I think this is why we end up with all these like virtuosic sort of players like you, Steve Eyes, and things like that. We all sort of compete against each other. It's quite a...
Is that like a male psyche thing or is that across the genders?
Yeah, it does seem to be sort of like a bit of a...
Because there's some great female players, obviously.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, like Jennifer Batten, who played with like Michael Jackson's incredible. But yeah, it might be a bit of a machismo thing, but I think it's healthy competition.
Yeah.
Yeah, you push each other, don't you? And because that's the thing, you see, it is a healthy competition because I love seeing other players doing amazing things. Mm. And all it is inspires me to try.
And you love jamming as well, do you?
Yeah, that interaction with other players. Yeah. And
talking about other players, tell me a little bit about some of the kind of... That was your first band.
Yeah.
So over the years, have there been other bands which, you know, longer term things?
Well, yeah, when I came back to Cardiff then... I played in like school, like jazz bands and things like that. But me and a bunch of friends started like a stoner rock group called Mondo Trans Shop. We played Mondo Trans Shop, Mondo Trans with a Z Shop.
Good name.
Yeah, and we played sort of really heavy, doomy, sludgy, and sort of often sort of stoner grooves. We did a lot of gigs with them. That developed into a band later on called Black Caesar, which was an instrumental band, no vocals. And I played the lap steel on that. So
wow.
But it was still heavy. Hmm. So I played lap steel going through distortion pedals and overdrives and
wow.
adding lots of delays and effects on it. But alongside that, I used to play in an indie band called Circus Normal. I'm actually rejoining those guys. Ben, the lead singer from that, Ben Willis, is currently working on some recordings and he's starting to gig a lot. And he's gigging in St David's Hall in a couple of weeks with Amy Wadge. He writes a few songs with Amy.
Yeah.
So that's a project called Lunar Rescue at the moment. So I'm working with them. And it's nice because I haven't worked with those boys for probably over 15 years.
Mm.
We met up in the Birchgrove pub a couple of Sundays back to sort of organise a practice, and so we're going to plough ahead with that. Over the last 4 years, I've been doing a really fun project called Raider,
yeah.
which is essentially an 80s hair metal outfit.
Is it like a self-conscious kind of, to some extent, sort of parody bit going on there at all?
Homage. We don't like the term parody, so we don't want to create like a Steel Panther thing.
Yeah,
it's more like we genuinely love music from that period, and we generally love the sort of big sort of him, you know, your White Snakes and your Van Halens. And it's something that I never thought I'd do, because in 1990, when it was all over, and that wasn't cool anymore, because like people like Kurt Cobain was on the scene, I was 14. So I could never have done that type of music back then, because it wasn't just cool. But I think it's there's been enough of a gap now, so that it's 30 years later, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a long time.
30 to 40 years later, and people accept it. I think it's the nostalgia of it as well. People know these songs and these rock songs from, you know, 80s movies and
you
things
playing
like
covers?
That. No covers, it's all originals.
Yeah.
Yeah, we thinking of introducing a cover to the set, but no, it's all purely original stuff.
But it kind of nods towards that stuff.
Yeah, and nods to the 80s, really. Yeah, it's all about fun.
Hmm.
Music often is quite sort of solemn and serious, and musicians are often
very
introverted.
Well, I've seen some videos. I don't see much of that going on.
No, we're not introverts. No, there's no room for introverts in this band. No,
this is the one where the singer's got... What does the singer do? He's got a great voice, but I think he uses some sort of technique to make the voice sound huge. I think you told me about it before.
Gang vocals, possibly. Those like to get those big sort of Def Leppard gang vocals.
Massive vocals.
Yeah, so you just keep overlaying the same voice over and over again, and it helps if you've got more than one singer.
But you recreate it live somehow, don't you, as well?
We do cheat a little bit, I suppose. Yeah, you could call it cheat. It's not cheating. It's utilising technology, processes, vocal processes.
Oh, yeah.
We use, like everyone does these days, we play to click and a backing track.
Okay.
So we can introduce extra keyboards, backing vocals to our live show, things that we can actually do.
In-ear monitors? Or?
For the drummer, yes.
Yeah. That involves a fair bit of shredding, no doubt, does it?
It does. Yeah. I'm not as dexterous as I used to be, but
could you demo a little shred?
Not on this guitar.
I was wondering if you could on the acoustic, actually. I like that one when you're playing it and then you're like hitting the string further up.
Oh, the tapping thing.
Yeah,
so
I love
this
that stuff.
Everyone thinks Eddie Van Halen invented this.
Yeah,
but he
was known for it, wasn't he, I suppose?
So that type of nonsense, really.
That's
very
nice on a Yamaha acoustic
guitar. Yeah, you need like a Jackson or a Chavel or
something.
Yeah,
I know you like those. I'm just asking you about your favourite guitars. I know you like Chavels and Jacksons. Is it the look, the feel, the sound, or the whole shoot and match?
It's the feel, because I remember my first professional standard guitar. Again, it was bought in Picton Arcade, so I went back there about 2 years later after I bought my first guitar, after being told not to buy a bass. I used to do like some acting when I was a kid. I used to do like I did a TV programme for HTV Wales, like a historical drama. So I had a bit of money in the bank, but I think my budget was about 250 quid to 300 quid.
When was this?
Oh, 1989.
Fair bit of money then, really? At the time.
Enough to meet. It was good that I had those sort of like acting opportunities, really, and made a bit of money that way. So I walked into the Picton Arcade and...
Same guy?
I can't remember, to be honest, but I liked that shop.
Yeah.
So Yeah, I tried a few guitars out, and I thought I made a decision, but I wasn't going for that pointy sort of metal guitar. I was looking for a more traditional sort of normal-looking guitar, you know, like a Strat or like something like that. And my dad's just for a laugh, I think, or just like of interest, he said, I wonder what makes £1,000 guitar better than a £300 guitar better, you know.
It's a brave comment for a father to make.
I know, it's a bit stupid on his part, really.
Yeah.
So he, and I saw, well, I like, there was a white Jackson soloist and a black Jackson soloist. And so he pulled down the black Jackson soloist and said, oh, I like this. It looks mean. It looks thrash metal, you know. It looks
like, get that look, haven't they? Yeah.
Like, it looks like a guitar Metallica would use, or Anthrax or something like that. Mm. Played it and it was fine. And I could tell it was higher qualities instantly. But then, so that went back on the shelf. And then the white Jackson came down, which wasn't my favourite in terms of aesthetic. But for some reason, I put that in my lap and I went, oh my God, this just feels right. Everything ergonomically, it just felt right.
Yeah.
It felt easy to play. It just screamed quality. Mm. And I turned to my dad and said, sorry, mate, I don't think I can go back to after playing this, I'm not going to be able to... Mm. I'm not going to be happy with that £300 guitar. So, thankfully, my dad's an awesome haggler. I had a bit more money than £300, I think. I think I had £500, but I wanted to keep some savings back. He managed to haggle it down to £700 cash.
Right.
And fair play to him, he put up the other £200. And to that day, to this day, that's still my favourite guitar. Still my go-to guitar.
It's nice, yeah.
Yeah.
Have you got a name for your guitar?
A Jackie, I guess.
Fair enough.
I think she's a female, I'm sure. Yeah, yeah.
So how many guitars have you got now?
Oh, is my wife going to hear this?
Not necessarily.
No. I have around 27 things with strings on. So that includes basses, banjos, mandolin.
Do you hide some of them away?
I do. I have some in the office that my other half doesn't know about yet.
Because I see sometimes boxes coming in which look like guitar-shaped boxes, you know?
Yeah, I've got a bit of a problem with that. I started buying up all those. I still, like, write off to Jackson magazine every year, pretending that I was interested in buying another Jackson. I couldn't afford that, obviously. But what they used to do then was send you a brochure. So you'd get a yearly brochure. So I was doing these mental wish lists when I was a kid, going through these guitars and saying, when I grow up, I want this one, I want that one.
Yeah.
So what I've been doing is finding these old 80s and 90s guitars on eBay.
And gradually putting the set together.
Yeah, and buying those things that I wanted when I was a kid. And I've always, the plan was to get the guitar, restore them, put them back to factory spec. So a lot of them have been altered and modded. So I'd put the original parts back in and get it as it came out of the factory, basically, with an eye to sell it.
Mm.
Once I've done that, as soon as I've finished the project, I go, oh, this is far too
cool. We all know you're not going to sell them.
No, because it's far too cool an instrument. Yeah, I've got something invested in this now, so, yeah.
Yeah, I hate selling guitars. I always regret it when I sell guitars. Yeah. You know, it's kind of, you know, simple mathematics, you know. Really, don't want to be cruel to you, but you don't really need 27 of them.
No, I don't. You know? No. Some of them are the same guitar, but in a different finish.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm a bit of a completist. Mm. I think that's me anyway. I've got over 100 yo-yos, Steve. Yeah,
have
I'm
you?
Obsessed with yo-yos as well.
Okay.
So I've got
we'll do a show about yo-yos.
150 yo-yos at least.
Wow.
Ranging from things from a quid up to one yo-yo was recommended retail price of £150.
Whoa.
But, you know, to justify this, it is made of aircraft grade aluminium.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah.
Worth the money.
Yeah, it's well balanced.
How many acoustic guitars do you have?
Well, I have a Spanish guitar, because I did some classical playing when I was younger as well.
Oh, yeah.
I've got a nice sort of semi-acoustic Charvel.
I haven't seen that.
And I've got a 12-string guitar as well, which is also a Charvel. This is a theme. I'm a big Charvel and Jackson fan.
Yeah, I've noticed. Do you have any kind of... I don't know, I don't want to put you on the spot at all, but do you have any kind of finger-picking technique kind of guidance for acoustics, by any chance? Is it like, you know, people talk about the claw and this, that, and the other. Is there a simple routine somebody could learn?
My starting point was just sort of the classical technique. So you don't really use your little finger. You use your three middle fingers and your thumb. So the thumb does the bass.
Yeah.
And
I never use a little finger.
Yeah, some people do. So I think, like, the first simple classical piece that I learned was the Spanish Romance, was it? So do you know that piece?
Yeah, it's lovely.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful piece. It's very simple to play. Mm. But the right hand does same pattern. the right hand does the same pattern over and over again. Mm. And it's just working through the fingers. Thumb and... I can't remember the names of your fingers. We have letters for them. Pima. P-I-M-E.
Okay.
But you just do this sort of repeating pattern, really. And again, over time, it just builds up that muscle memory and it just becomes quite natural to just use your fingers. Yeah, I think
Do you do sort of gypsy jazz stuff at all?
Not really, no. I sort of played around with certain techniques. Mm. I'm going to find a different tuning now. Like my old teacher, Viv Locke, used to show me a couple of things.
Who was your guitar teacher?
He was, for about a year when I was about 17, 18. Yeah.
He's still knocking around, isn't he?
Yeah, he's still playing and still examining. He's great, Viv.
Yeah.
He's a superstar.
Yeah.
Yeah, I started playing with like around these like sort of bluesy sort of things. But yeah, getting that sort of percussive sort of claw hammer type of techniques. But
that's nice. What tuning is that then?
That's a drop. You drop your A down to a G, so it's a drop G, really.
Okay. And you can play open tuning stuff then, yeah?
I don't. I'm a out and out lead player, really. I should have brought one of my Jacksons in so I could get the whammy bar action on the go, you know? Yeah, but I've dabbled in acoustic playing and acoustic, but like I say.
That's great. That blue stuff on the acoustics, that's really nice.
Yeah. But. Yeah, again, like a lot of players I know, they just dedicate so much time to playing solo. But for me, the most fun you can get out of music is playing with other people and bouncing off other people in bands.
Yeah.
So that's when I was that guy at a party, you're a guitar player, plays a song. And I said, well, I can't. I can just play the lead line. I need my bassist and my drummer and the singer here, you know. But I'm happy in that role, really. I'm happiest in that role.
But if you were at a party or like a campfire or whatever and somebody started playing guitar, no doubt, because of your knowledge of the scales, you could pretty well jam along to anything. Play by ear, I guess, as well.
Yeah, I do that, yeah. I guess someone has to sing and play the chords and then I'll just do some pretty stuff on the top.
And you can play what you hear, I suppose.
To an extent, yeah.
And when did you, I guess you read...
Yes.
So when did you start reading music?
Well, that happened before the guitar, you see, because of obviously...
In school?
Yes, and I did violin lessons first
in
school.
Oh, of course, and then the brass instruments.
Then the piano, then the brass.
You're walking music shop, really, aren't you, you know?
Yeah, I know.
You can work in every department.
I know, yeah. Master of none, though.
Well, I don't know about that. On that subject, I'm just got in my mind a few things I want to ask you. Gambling's closing down, kind of the emotional kind of feel of that.
It's a shame.
End of an era in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, because that was my go-to shop.
Not the friendliest shop always, but well stocked.
No, I think there was a certain way to get on side.
Oh yeah. You had the trick, did you?
Yeah.
What was the trick then?
I'm not really sure. I think it was being polite to the mother.
And, yes.
Yeah. And just being respectful, really. And I think you know, when they hear you play and think, oh, he's not a bad player, then maybe you would have got slightly more sort of positive experience in there.
I think Mrs. G was always, my memories of her was, whatever you do, you know, is kind of the golden rule, do not pick up a book with chords in it and start trying to learn a song. You know, looking, you know, this is not a library was one of her favourite quotes.
But
it is sad, when those kind of things happen. Of course, the high street in Cardiff, we had cranes, and then
got
PMT, which is a big kind of behemoth, really, isn't it?
Yeah, big
blows
chain.
The stuff out of the water.
Yeah.
What about on that kind of similar topic, really, kind of venues closing down, a kind of evolution of music in Cardiff? Where are we at in your opinion at the moment in Cardiff as a kind of a centre for music?
Well, I think it's still a great city for music. I'm not as pessimistic. Obviously, I'm a bit long in the tooth, so I'm not as pessimistic as a lot of people about venues closing down. The loss of Goody Who is devastating, because that was genuinely my favourite music.
And we walk past it every day, don't we? And it's just a wall with paint on it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, and it's quite sad, isn't it? And it's such good proximity to the university.
Yeah.
And they were so accommodating. I could... It was my exam room.
Nice beer as well, if I remember.
Nice beer. Yeah, nice people.
Yeah.
It was inclusive.
Cozy,
Yeah. But I remember when that wasn't there as well. So in terms of venues closing...
They come and they go, I suppose.
They come and they go, yeah. And as long as they keep coming as fast as they're going, I think we're okay. I think like Tiny Rebel in town is starting to get a really good reputation as a as a music venue, and that wasn't there a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's true.
And a music venue, and yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's some of our students as well who are quite involved with, you know, the Vulcans coming through now. It's kind of, you know, being run by a lad called Mike, and putting on gigs at least.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
You know, there's music festivals going on, so it does kind of swing around. People obviously talk about the epicenter, of course, being Womanby Street.
Yeah,
and, you know,
yeah, yeah.
It's a political kind of nature to that, isn't
it? That's
it.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, music is kind of as a kind of cultural form and what it brings to the city. So if you know, there was sort of this kind of hoo-ha about these venues closing down, which I totally understand and support. Yeah. Yeah? But as you say, these venues, and they come and they go. But historically, if we look at music and performance of music, and you compare it to other forms of the arts, such as notably, you know, theatre and this kind of stuff, you know, it's kind of, oh yeah, it's only music, you know, it's just just some guy playing a few chords, chuck a couple of coins in the pot. You know, why does music matter?
Well, there is a problem in terms of the perception of its value, I think.
High class, low class kind of stuff.
Yeah, possibly. Hmm. You know, people go and watch a film and there's music, isn't it? And you know, people go into an elevator and there's often music. People get put on hold and there's music. Okay, it's not great music.
It doesn't necessarily be amazing music.
But yeah, it's everywhere, isn't it? But maybe because it's so ubiquitous, that's why people don't think it's valuable. But it is valuable because bands getting booked for certain functions or weddings or gigs often like demand quite a high fee. And people always equate it to, hang on, you're getting this many hundreds of pounds or thousands of pounds to play an hour and a half. You're only working an hour and a half. And they go, well, hang on. No, it's not just that hour and a half you're getting paid for. You're getting paid for those 20,000 hours that you put in to learn your instrument and hone your craft. Mm. They're paying for the equipment that's quite expensive. You can talk like a professional setup for a guitar play, you know, could set you back thousands of pounds in itself. All those other things that you don't actually see, you know, there's more to music than that 45 minutes or an hour that you see a band on stage. It's like I can't remember when I think it was Keith Richards or one of the Stones, I'm not sure, I may be incorrect, and someone said, what's it been like playing music for 50 years? And he said, well, I haven't been playing music for 50 years, I've been playing music for about 3 months and the rest of it was hanging around. or doing other stuff, you know.
That's kind of thing Keith Richards probably would say. His book is fantastic. Have you read it?
No.
Oh, you got to read Keith.
Okay.
It's absolutely fantastic. You love it.
Okay.
As a guitarist, he talks about the tunings and the way he plays the Stones chords, and when you hear it, it's there, you know.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's a really fantastic book. Here's one. Here's a starter for 10. Yeah, I've just been reading this article, and it's essentially saying, like, kind of other kind of artifacts over the years, how they get devalued. As we go into this kind of realm of bedroom artists and EDM, et cetera, you know, are guitars a dying thing? You know, do we still need guitars? Will we still need them in a few years? Are we starting to get challenged by the notion of a physical thing called a guitar? You know, we can recreate them as software, you know.
It's such a tactile instrument. I don't.
It's breaking your heart now. I can see in your face.
No, I'm not scared. I'm not threatened. No, I think it'll always be there. Like, you know. You know, certain genres of music will always need guitars. If you think of like heavy metal, for example, and that's a beast that's never gone away. It's remained constant, isn't it? And that genre of music is still picking up new fans, and the genre's developing. So no, I don't feel threatened. I think kids will always, there'll be a healthy number of kids who will always want to play guitar and play it loud and fast.
Good. I agree. I hope you're right. But, you know, I mean, it's kind of one of these things, you know, people say radio's dead, you know.
Yeah.
It very, very much kind of isn't. But, you know, they're kind of these tales and myth go around.
Didn't they also say that microwaves would kill home cooking? Technological pessimism, I think this
is.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of that. Also, how can people find out more about Raider?
We're on Spotify, Raider, all the social media platforms.
Okay.
Raider Music UK on Facebook and Instagram and all these things.
Okay, and hopefully we can add up a link for you and send some great pictures and whatever. We stick them on, you know, put them on the site.
Thank you.
But also then with the Welsh language kind of thing, because I suppose, you know, like Wales is a pretty small place, but you know, it's a long walk sort of thing. But you know, people tend to know each other.
Yeah.
And we talked about the music scene in Cardiff and what's happened to that. We talked about the guitar as a kind of a physical thing, and these kind of commercial pressures are on us all the time. So in terms of the Welsh music scene within the music scene itself, is that equally challenged? Is it a good time for Welsh musicians? Is it just the same as English, or is it different? I don't know.
I think it's still really healthy, and I think it's as healthy as it's ever been. I think we've got one great band, and I'm in the second year, Holly, she's in a band called Adwaith.
Oh yeah,
who recently won.
They get quite a lot of attention, don't they?
Yeah, they're fantastic, and they recently won the Welsh Music Prize. One of the big advantages of being on the Welsh music scene and being able to like sing in Welsh is that you can get professionalised quite quickly in terms of, because it's a smaller pool. It's easier for the bands to get tracks onto radio, so they get that sort of exposure to professional environments maybe possibly a lot quicker than people on the English language scene, because obviously there's more competition there and a greater mass of bands and musicians doing it. So I think that's good. And well, I just want to show off about my students now, that we also got a master's student called Rydian, who became second in Canny Grymry, which is Song for Wales, on the weekend. Yeah, I think the Welsh language music scene is fighting fit and has been for quite some time.
And on not quite as positive a note, but not quite as prestigious a note, of course, the university here, we create that sampler album every year, which is currently going on. What's it called again?
Create Vinyl. So yeah, all the tracks are contributed to by students. Then we have this wonderful evening of listening to all the tracks and debating which one should make the final list.
I don't agree with that old boy. I think.
I know. Yeah,
and it's rock and roll.
And and genre.
Pass the port.
Yeah, genre preferences come into it, and then we argue about, is production important? It sounds great. The song's great, but the production isn't that great. Oh, is that important? What's important? I don't know. Yeah. But,
well, that's music, isn't there? Those kind of arguments. That's what makes music so fascinating, really, because there isn't really a right or wrong.
No, exactly. Yeah.
And of course, we also had the Immersed Festival, and that was very successful. And again, that was this isn't a corporate kind of podcast, but
no.
Great that the university does that stuff and has that kind of impact through music, I think.
Yes. Yeah. It is. It's really good, and it just puts us on the map as well. I think the main triumph from these events is that your average punter doesn't even know that it's a student project. So it's a student project led by students, run by students. They put on an event in the tram shed. They fill the place out with 1,000 people, and it's just as good as any other event that you'd go to, you know.
And talking about events, we have to go to an event soon, don't we?
We do. Yeah, we've got a very exciting event this afternoon.
Alan, thanks a million for coming in. Great to talk to you.
Cheers. Thank you.